and welcome to the American Compass podcast. I'm Oren Kass, Executive Director at American Compass, and today we're back with another episode from our new Policy in Brief series, which, as you may discern from the title, is brief discussions of policy.
And as one must when discussing policy proposals, I'm joined, as I always will be, by American Compass's Policy Director, Chris Griswold. Chris, say hello to the listeners.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. So I think what we've got for a plan here is each of these episodes will pick one specific policy issue to talk through in depth. We'll start with the actual proposal and then run through a whole bunch of things we might want to talk about. Why there's a problem to be solved, what the most compelling argument is for it, what the most compelling argument is against it. And then for those who actually make it to the end, we will each propose our own very best acronymed Capitol Hill bill title that will be sure to grab media headlines. So are you ready?
I'm so ready.
All right. What have you got for us today?
Well, today we're talking about keeping kids safe online and specifically on social media. And there's a lot of different elements to this, but first, and kind of almost as a prerequisite to any of the others, we need to figure out a way to verify online who is and is not a kid without sacrificing privacy. So my proposal, what I think we should be doing and what we've written about at American Compass is that Congress should create a online system that you can use to verify your age while retaining your anonymity and privacy. I think a natural place to do that would be at the Social Security Administration, right? We do this all the time, right? If you lose your bank password, you log on, you get a two-factor authentication kind of code sent to your phone, proof who you are, and then you can get access to your account. I think we can do something like that at Social Security Administration. We would log on to an online portal, input your Social Security number, a little bit of authentication to make sure it's really you, and you haven't like bought someone's number online or something like that. And then be given a temporary code that would say nothing except whether you are above or below a certain age. And you take that code to Facebook or Instagram, social media platform of your choice, and input it when creating an account. And all that would tell that platform is whether you are above or below a certain age without telling social media companies or the government anything further about who you are and what you're doing. And I think we can get into why that's important and why I think that's probably the right approach. But I think the bottom line is that if we're going to tell social media sites that they have to treat kids differently than adults, or that they can only let them on the platform under certain conditions required by law, which, by the way, is absolutely something we need to do, then we're going to have to give these companies some way to know if a user is or is not a kid without sacrificing everyone's privacy.
Right. So I like this idea, I think, because as you were just saying, we already do this all the time. In fact, even with Facebook and other places, every month or so, if you're going to log in, they put you through that extra step of also texting you a code that you have to type in as well to make sure you are who you say you are. And as you said, the Social Security Administration already knows who we all are, or at least knows the age and birth date of everybody with a Social Security number. And so it seems like as we move our lives online to an increasing degree, having some sort of online equivalent of the standard identification procedures that governments provide for us in the real world is something we might need for all sorts of things, but certainly we're going to need it if we need to know who's an adult and who isn't. That the old "no one knows if you're a dog on the internet" maybe shouldn't be so true anymore.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's important to point out that this is, in some ways, an entirely new problem, right? We haven't encountered, as a society, the digital age. The digital age is new, and policymakers haven't really caught up and figured out how to govern well in a context where we're all living so much of our lives in online spaces. And I think that's important because a lot of people kind of have this resignation that there's nothing we can do, and that what happens online just simply cannot be made safe for children. And at least in the case of social media, I just don't think that's true. And the fact that we haven't done it before doesn't mean we can't. And you know, one of the unique things that a solution like this really has to solve for, the needle it has to thread, is that it has to be able to prove your age. And as I said, it has to be able to also protect your anonymity. And that's why I think it's a public responsibility, right? Because all of the solutions that these companies are coming up with themselves are all incredibly invasive of privacy. They're also just super clunky and like awkward and annoying to use, right? But the kinds of things that like Instagram is working on now are, you know, what, like having AI scan your face and then figure out algorithmically whether they think you're above a certain age. Sometimes they'll, you know, you have to upload your actual government ID, in which case they know everything about you. Sometimes they, you know, require you to upload a video selfie and they'll just decide whether you seem to be the right age. All of these are awkward and they're invasive of privacy. And look, one of the problems with social media is how much they know about us, right? Their business model is to monetize our attention and our personal data. Giving them more personal data, in my opinion, is certainly not the solution to how to keep kids safe on social media. Yeah, and that's why I think that it's a public thing.
Yeah, and so I guess we've been thinking about, all right, how do we actually talk through an issue like this? And obviously the place to start is, well, okay, what's the actual problem we're trying to solve? Like, we could stipulate, hey, we could set up a really cool platform at the Social Security Administration, but the preliminary question is why bother? And I think we probably each have our own theory of what the most important reason is. I think one of the striking things about the tech debates is the extent to which people just have 5, 10, 15 different things they don't like, and they'll sort of just throw them all together and think that makes a compelling case. But let's narrow in on that. I have my answer, but what is your sort of, if there was one reason we need this, what is it?
It's a broad reason, but it's also the most important reason, which is that social media is hurting kids, period. That is happening. And the research continues to kind of pile up to demonstrate that it's happening. And it happens along a couple different vectors. But in the big picture, right, I mean, we see this massive explosion of mental and emotional health challenges in kids and teenagers over the same period of time that American kids have migrated their social lives online. And we can have a long debate about correlation and causation, but you know, if you look at researchers like Jonathan Haidt and many others who have studied this, they really can't find any better explanation for these exploding levels of anxiety and depression, even self-harm among kids than this social media phenomenon. It's very clearly a major part of the problem. And if you accept that, if you accept that social media is hurting kids in very serious ways, well, then you've got to figure out how to do something about it. And that probably means putting some parameters around social media that are specific to kids, which is why you have to know who is and isn't a kid.
Yeah, I think that connects somewhat to what I see as probably the biggest problem that we're trying to solve here. And it goes to this question of, like, well, can we prove that kids are being harmed by this? And it's such a funny sort of technocratic way of framing the issue, because that's not really what we ask, generally speaking. When we say, well, you know, we probably shouldn't, you know, bring kids into strip clubs, no one says, like, well, wait a minute, where's your, you know, regression analysis on that? It's just like, actually, there are some spaces out there in the world that, you know, they're certainly not going to be illegal. We're going to let adults do what they want, but we also have an agreement that kids shouldn't be there. And it seems like, a little bit to your point earlier, that we just haven't caught up in our thinking about the online world, that increasingly the online world isn't just a set of services we use. It is, in a sense, where people spend parts of their lives. Certainly, I think the evidence suggests that's how kids perceive it in a lot of cases. And if you think about what, you know, Facebook is getting at in changing its name to Meta, the intention of these companies is to make that even more the case. And so unless we can come up with some reason. I guess you could say, well, actually, it's foolish that we have age distinctions in the offline world. We should do away with that. We don't like it, but.
But we shouldn't take those people seriously, Oren. That's not a serious argument.
Well, I appreciate that. Any of you listeners who feel that way can go ahead and sign off now. But for everybody else,
email comments welcome. Right
here. That's right. You can tag Chris on Twitter. He's at Chris_Grizz with a Z, and he welcomes your comments. But assuming we believe that that's a useful thing, we have to find a way to translate that into the online world as well. And I think we have to have the confidence, whether as just people discussing what we want from our society, what sorts of environments we want to have for children. And then ultimately, you know, policymakers have to be willing to stand up and say, you know, actually, no, that's not a place kids should be. And if we're willing to say that, then as you said in kicking us off, we have to be willing to say, and we're going to, then we got to have a way to know whether or not you're a kid.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And it also goes to another important point in my mind, which is just to highlight what I said before, which is that this is a novel challenge. This is a new challenge that policymakers haven't really figured out like how to categorize. But if we think about what is in fact the case, right, like I believe it's about 45% of American teenagers are online almost constantly by their own report, right? This is where kids live their social lives. It's just how it is. And that's only going to increase rather than decrease. You mentioned Meta, right? Like Mark Zuckerberg's vision is that we live our lives in an actual, like, you know, virtual environment. That's only going to increase. And if we can't get our heads around the fact that that requires some updated thinking in the policy space, then we're just going to continue to see the harms to kids that we see now.
Yeah. Yeah. The 45% live constantly or are constantly online is fascinating to me. I think when I think about, okay, what are the most compelling stats? I guess that's one of them. The one that sticks out in my mind is Instagram in particular. And I guess the most recent data suggests about 40% of kids ages 9 to 12 are on Instagram daily, which is mind-blowing to me for a couple of reasons. One, like, so does that mean that, like, they have smartphones? Like, from where are kids of that age just spending online, even spending time online daily? But then also, of course, by definition, Instagram isn't supposed to have people under the age of 13 with accounts. And so, you know, it underscores in my mind just the extent to which our existing infrastructure is just for regulating these things is essentially just a joke, right? Like, I guess
it is. No, it's laughable. It's totally laughable.
Yeah. And I guess it was back in essentially in the 90s that we started to create these rules like, all right, you know, no kids under 13 on this service or that service. And we haven't done anything since. And at the point where literally, you know, it'd be like if you looked around and said, wow, you know, 40% of kids under the age of 16, you know, had driven a car in the last, you know, we're driving cars daily. And you just say like, well, obviously we're going to need to do something about
that. Yeah, right. Well, and let's just stop and reflect for a minute. You know, it was the late 90s, as you said, that this law was written. I mean, just the state of technology at that time was just radically different, right? You've got dial-up, you know, it's presumably on a huge computer in a room in your house that everyone can see, that only one or two people can be on at a time. Maybe depending on what kind of, you know, situation you have, you can't be on the phone at the same time that you're on the, right? Like, this is the era in which this law was written. And if you read some of what the senators who worked on that law in the 90s say now, they themselves regret that they didn't do a better job. It's a completely inadequate legal apparatus for dealing with the reality of how technology works now, and that these really are virtual spaces in which we live our lives. And they're completely inadequate for protecting kids in those spaces, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, so all right, what's your favorite stat? When you've got someone cornered at the cocktail party, what are you thrusting your finger into their chest and saying?
you stole, I think, one of the great ones, which is if you think the current system is working, well, just check. Like, nigh unto half of American kids 9 to 12 are already on Instagram every day. But you can... I've got two, actually, that I would say. One is quite serious, which just kind of puts some vivid numbers to the harm that social media is causing. And that's that hospital admission rates for self-harm by girls ages 10 to 14. So this is around the same age range that we're talking about. Doubled between 2010 and 2014. So 100% increase in hospital admission rates for self-harm by girls in that age range. And that's the same period of time that you start to see this mass migration of teenage social life online. And again, you know, not to get down a causation versus correlation rabbit hole, but it's stats like that, and there are many other stats of the same kind of nature that researchers look at, and they have not found a better explanation. Social media is very, very clearly a major driver of this mental and emotional health crisis that we're seeing our kids experience.
Well, and I think you've made this point also that it's not just sort of third-party researchers. Facebook's own internal data,
yes,
when it leaks, shows that they know and believe this as well.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, the just unbelievable... stuff that they themselves are like completely aware of, like their own leaked research, right? That Instagram use makes body image challenges for young girls worse for one in three of them. You know, like one in five of all teens feel worse about themselves after being on Instagram, and including some really, really dark stuff, right? Of, you know, kids who have thought about harming themselves or even killing themselves. You know, it was something like 6% of kids who said, you know, I've recently thought about killing myself, you know, that thought originated due to Instagram use. So it gets really bad. And they know this. And this is a really important point, and I'm glad you raised it. Why are they continuing to do what they do despite knowing? They've got the numbers. They've had them for years. Despite knowing? Well, here's another stat, which is that social media ad revenue by the end of this year is projected to be about like $57 billion, right? And this is a really important thing to, I think, to stop and reflect on for a minute, which is the incentives that social media are driven by, right? They aren't created as kind of, you know, public good organizations to take care of your kids and guide their development in a healthy way. They exist to make money, and they do that by capturing your attention for as long as possible so that eyeballs are in front of advertisements, and also by capturing your personal data and selling it. And that means that these companies, number one, don't have a terribly big incentive to keep kids off of their platform. And they say that quite openly, that it's an economic imperative that they keep kids on their platform. It's certainly the basis of their future financial security to kind of secure the next generation of users young. And that's why they do what they do despite knowing the harm. And I think that's just another case, a point in favor of the case for public policy response, because these incentives are terribly malformed and misaligned, and we got to do something about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've persuaded everyone of the brilliance of the idea. So, let's flip it around, talk about kind of best and worst arguments against doing something. So you can go first. You want to throw out a good argument or a lousy one?
I'm going to throw out a lousy one. Here's an argument that I think is a terrible, terrible argument, but that a lot of people make, and it's often the first one that they make, and that's that this is parents' job. And the reason that's such a problematic argument, number one, is that it sounds right on the front end. Of course it's parents' jobs to protect their kids. We all believe that because it's true, right? Of course, parents have the first and primary responsibility for keeping their kids safe. But when people throw that objection out there, like, we don't need a nanny state kind of hijacking the parental role We just need parents to be better. I think that fundamentally misunderstands what's really happening here, which is that parents are themselves just as outmatched by the nature and design of social media as their kids are. The leaked research that you mentioned talks about that. It talks about how parents just totally technologically kind of ignorant. They don't have enough know-how to protect their kids. There are many other studies that, you know, even when parents succeed in kind of governing their kids' social media use, it's really usually only around when and where they can use social media. So like no smartphones at the dinner table, or like no Instagram when you're supposed to be studying. But that can't protect kids from the much more dangerous kind of and darker kind of harms and risks that these platforms represent. And then lastly, right, good luck telling your kid to get off of the social media platform wherein all of their friends are living their lives. It's just not, but you kind of have, you have a collective action problem. You've got a network effect problem. And so I think the reason why this argument is so bad is that it just doesn't reflect reality. Parents, in my view, are themselves in need of policy support, so precisely so that they can better exercise their primary responsibility of keeping their kids safe. But they can't do it alone, right? And that's what we do for alcohol, tobacco, and plenty of other things, right? If you're a parent, you know, you have kids, you're not going to let your young kids go buy booze. But you know, we also make it illegal to sell booze to kids, as we should. We back parents up in that way.
Yeah. I think the offline online parallel there is really important. But I'd say I find the network effects argument especially compelling, and even in thinking about kind of how do we describe the core problem here, I think the network effect is such a big piece of it that all of the same sort of economic and social forces that lead to these social media platforms being valuable, being powerful, all have, in addition, the effect of drawing kids onto them and making it essentially impossible is too strong, but frankly undesirable for parents to pull their kids back off of them. I mean, you might say, you know, I don't like this Instagram and what risks it might pose for my kid, but if that's the only way that social plans get made, you know, if that's what everybody's doing, are you really going to tell your kid they can't do that? It's I think an incredibly tough problem that parents are facing and that they're facing at ever younger ages for their kids. And I guess the flip side of it, that you know, one of the best things, and I'll throw out a stupid argument here because I think this fits into this exact point. You know, another argument here is like, well, there are ways to get around this, right? If you, you know, you could go buy a fake social security number and get a code from someone in Kenya and I think we would stipulate, you know, of course this isn't going to be airtight. Of course there are going to be ways to get around it, just again as there are in the offline world. But what you're doing is shifting the default. Instead of it being a situation where everyone is online and the school either accepts it or knows it has to tolerate it and parents don't really know what to say about it, you're shifting to, well, no, that you can't do that because it's literally illegal. And if you're telling me you're on anyway, it's because you defrauded the government. So you know, if you don't have to prevent everybody from ever getting on to take away that network effect. And if most people aren't on it most of the time, then it I think really loses its allure as the valuable place where people want and need to be.
Or at the very least, I think it breaks the status quo for Silicon Valley as well, right? Where it sends a very strong signal to them that if they're going to continue to offer this kind of product, this kind of platform, they're going to have to make it safe for kids, which is also, again, I think a matter for other policy discussions of what a child-safe version of social media looks like. But you know, if you're talking about how easy it is, you know, or could be to get around, like I think you could probably design a system pretty well to control for a lot of that. But yeah, of course you're right. There'll always be some, you know, porousness to a system like this. But I agree with you entirely. That's not the point. The point is to shift the status quo for parents and families and that dynamic, as you said, but also for Silicon Valley, you know. And if we put them on the hook for compliance, that also, I think, goes a long way to shifting their incentives in a healthy way. I'll throw out, maybe one of the better arguments or maybe stronger arguments, which is on the technical side, right? So if, for example, a social security number really is the most natural choice for your kind of identifying thing to make use of a system like we're proposing, well, what about those who have lost their social security number, who don't, you know, who don't know it? I mean, you think of people who are homeless, or there are plenty of groups of people who may not have easy access to their social security number, and maybe even don't have one, even if they're a citizen or legal resident of the U.S. And that, I think, is you know, on the one hand, you know, fair enough, but on the other hand, I think it really comes down to how willing are you to accept that social media is actually hurting kids badly? Because if you accept that, in the same way that you accept, for example, that it's a good idea to keep kids out of strip clubs, as you said earlier, well, then I think you have to be willing to accept a little bit of fuzziness on the edges, right? So if I want to get into a club and I forget my ID, like, sorry, like, okay, do I have a kind of constitutional right to enter that establishment? Probably, but not if I forgot my ID, right? And that's just a price we accept as a society in order to get the much larger and more important benefit of keeping kids out of dangerous places. So that's how I see, I have some sympathy for that argument, and I think it's a fair conversation to have on how to provide for those communities of people. But I don't think it's a reason to not pursue reasonable age verification. We have to. If you are willing to stipulate, as the data suggests that you must, that kids are being harmed, then we've got to take action.
Yeah, well, and I think there are two other elements to that. I agree that as sort of a technical matter, you know, this is certainly a challenge or drawback of this model. It's not a perfect model by any means, but you know, one thing I think it's really important to emphasize is that all we're talking about is having age verification as a mechanism for restricting access to certain activities or essentially places online that we might say should be adult only. So it's not like, well, sorry, you can't get online if you don't have this. It's not even like, sorry, you know, you can't access Instagram or Facebook necessarily. It may be simple mm-hmm. as saying, sorry, mm-hmm. you can't publicly share photos if you don't have this. It is a prerequisite to allowing us to wall off spaces or activities for adults, while still leaving the prudential question of, okay, what are those spaces that we want to limit? And as long as we agree there are some spaces that we want to limit, mm-hmm. even if we're literally mm-hmm. only talking about pornographic websites, if there are some mm-hmm. spaces we genuinely want to limit and impose harsh penalties for failing to limit, then we do need this mechanism. So that strikes me as one thing to keep in mind.
And you know, or to that point, I think it may just be valuable to say out loud that we don't hate the internet. Right? There are plenty of really, really important things that happen online that Americans absolutely do have a right to access, right? And even social media specifically. And even in some of the research that we've already talked about, you know, the plus side of social media for kids, you know, the things that seem to be at least somewhat beneficial for kids are things like what? Like being able to talk to their family and friends more easily, being able to follow some kind of funny humor account that makes them feel better when they're having a bad day. And also, you know, sometimes if this is a platform a kid is most comfortable with, accessing, you know, really important information. Maybe they're in an abusive situation and don't know what to do, and this is how they know to reach out for help. Right? These are all totally valid and legitimately important uses of something like social media. And you know, we keep talking about child safe versions of these platforms. You know, a child safe version should allow for all of that, while protecting against the things that cause the harms that we've been talking about. So I agree with you entirely. It's important to make that distinction.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a great point. And then I think the other thing, and especially I think it's something for important for conservatives to think about, you know, conservatives will sometimes have the initial reaction to any new government program of any kind. You know, this is either, you know, big government or invasive or intrusive or burdensome. But, you know, there are a lot of places where I think folks on the right in particular are realizing we probably need to do a better job with identification than we have been doing, that there are actually sort of social and economic values at stake. And so, you know, certainly the push for voter ID is one example, the push for E-Verify to ensure that people are here legally to work. I think, you know, obviously you can take the other side of those positions as well, but it's important to recognize that there's not some just single sliding scale from you know, no government bad to big government, or excuse me, big government bad to no government good. We actually, in fact, have to look at the types of situations where ultimately it is in the interest of the common good to be able to verify things about people's identity, and where we do notice those things, there's probably a public role to play in completing that task.
Yeah, and you know, even setting aside those other examples, and I imagine we probably come at those specific examples differently, and we can have a really constructive debate on the merits of each of those individual cases. I think even just focusing really narrowly on this conversation, we just don't think that way about free markets or small government when it comes to keeping kids safe. So regardless of where you land, even on those other big picture questions, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a conservative of any stripe who's comfortable placing kids in imminent danger out of some ideological commitment to limited government. You're just not going to see it because that's not how any of our actual moral common sense works. That's not how we do it actually in other policy instances, right? Like, I'm sorry if you think, you know, a 9-year-old should be able to drive a car, but it's not going to happen. And nobody serious questions the wisdom of that.
Yeah, no, that's right. There's no one asking to reevaluate the impacts on innovation and growth if we keep kids out of casinos. We seem to have managed to find a consensus on that. Well, speaking of finding a consensus, we have reached the end of our discussion here, which brings us to the best part, where, as any good congressional staffer must, we've done our best to come up with a compelling name for this idea. Of course, in all cases, the best name would be Inflation Reduction Act, because all of our ideas will reduce inflation by more than the actual Inflation Reduction Act does. But hopefully we've got some other more on point ideas. Do you want to go first? Should I go first?
You know, I have the feeling that I'm going to get totally outmatched here. So why don't you go first, and then I can shamefacedly follow up with my inferior offerings.
Okay. Well, I'll give you my runner up first. My runner up is the Let's Only Give Older Folks Freedom Act. That's the Log Off Act. But I think people wouldn't be sure, like older folks might only talk about seniors. So I think that leaves a little bit to be desired, but
I have criticisms. We're going to stop right there.
You got to
replace freedom with Facebook, I think, because this has nothing to do with freedom. This has to do with keeping kids safe from social media. So let's only give older people Facebook, and if you can let Facebook stand in for TikTok and all the rest.
And Meta. All right, that's better. So you get partial credit for improving that one. But here's my actual name. It is the Children and Adults Require Different Terms for Having Access to Technology but Keep Identification Discreet Act. And that, if you were having trouble following along, is the Card That Kid Act.
Yeah, okay, all right. Although I think if I saw that Card That Kid Act, I would think there's like an epidemic of bars just not carding 12-year-olds.
Well, it's a metaphor.
That's the problem you're trying to solve? I'm just saying. All right, what about this? Here's mine. The Graham Act, as in I did it for the Graham. Guaranteeing Reasonable Age Verification Measures Act.
Are you trying to get age verification as one word?
I am, and I'll tell you exactly how. There's a dash. There's this hyphenated word, which I actually double checked is the correct way of articulating that, grammatically speaking. The Guaranteeing Reasonable Age Dash Verification Measures, the GRAM Act.
All right. Well, it's not as good as mine, but I appreciate your effort, and we appreciate all of you listening. This has been Policy in Brief from the American Compass podcast. The idea is online age verification. And Chris, tell them where they can learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to americancompass.org, you can see all of our work on technology policy, including a big collection of essays on this and other tech-related issues called Lost in the Supermarket. We talk about algorithms, we talk about privacy. It's a great collection from a lot of leading thinkers. I have written on this specific question of keeping kids safe online, including this policy idea and others, at the summer issue of National Affairs this year, where you can find it at National Affairs. And I think also, you know, if we'll put this in the show notes where the actual written policy brief, we've got a 2-page summary of this idea that you can go and see some of the stats we talked about and read the idea for yourself. And then there are also some other things that are in this universe, lest you think that we are way out there on an island. Yuval Levin over at AEI has recently written specifically about this idea in the New York Times. If you look at the recent bipartisan Kids Online Safety Act, one of the features of that act directs National Institute of Science and Technology to conduct a technical study into age verification methods. So there is a growing universe of people interested in getting this right.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you, listeners. And we will be back again soon with more Policy in Brief from American Compass.